28-year-old Venezuelan known as The Dude becomes one of classical music's biggest stories of the decade. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and ahead today, our Critics Week continues with a look at the best in classical music. And a break from the usual holiday fare when Anonymous 4 plays live in our studio. With his hair-raising performances, Latino background, and youthful vibe, conductor Gustavo Dudamel became not only the new music director at the L.A. Philharmonic, he was a big story for classical music this past decade. But it wasn't all rosy for the art form. Several American orchestras folded, the great Luciano Pavarotti passed away, and there were cries that the classical recording industry was dead. Even so, it was a decade in which opera came to movie theaters, small indie labels emerged, and chamber musicians found new outlets in bars and clubs. Here now to share her favorite albums of the decade in classical music is Anne Majette, the chief classical music critic of the Washington Post. Anne, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So, Gustavo Dudamel, the dude, takes over the L.A. Philharmonic this fall. There's lots of mainstream press coverage. His picture is plastered on the sides of buses all over town in L.A. He's on 60 Minutes. Doesn't make your top 10. Why?
Well, none of his recordings made my top 10. That's not to say that he wouldn't make my top 10. I think Gustavo Dudamel as a figure is certainly one of the most exciting things to happen to classical music. The kind of rock star level of charisma and excitement he brings to audiences and that you see in his concert halls is tremendous. I just don't think that the recordings yet have echoed that particular excitement, and I'm not even sure the performances have to my ear. I've been to some of the Bolivar Orchestra performances, and they're great, but there's a sense of obedience and slight restraint. I feel like his brilliance has not really taken an individual voice yet.
Well, he's only 28, which in conducting years is he's just a kid. So there's still much. Are you expecting that there'll be some growth?
Oh, tremendously. I think one of the great interests of the next decade will be to see where he decides to go, because he could go in many different directions. He could become kind of a carbon copy, doing brilliant covers, as it were, or he could find his own voice as a really unique conductor, as his predecessor, Esa-Pekka Salonen, also 28 when he was named to the L.A. Philharmonic, did do in Los Angeles.
I think Alex Ross in The New Yorker correctly pointed out people talk about Dudamel saving the L.A. Philharmonic. The L.A. Philharmonic didn't need saving because Esa-Pekka Salonen had gotten there first.
Absolutely.
What about New York and Alan Gilbert, who took over this fall here on this coast?
Well, Alan Gilbert perhaps had the bad fortune to be overshadowed by Dudamel in the charisma department. I think what Alan Gilbert's doing in New York, thinking about in New York, is fantastic. He has all the right ideas. I haven't had a chance this fall to hear very many of the performances. I wasn't wild about the opening performance, but he's a very able and a very smart conductor, and the whole impetus to do more new music and try to make the orchestra more a part of the community is very much in keeping with the spirit of classical music now at the end of this decade. I think the decade has seen a sea change in the way orchestras have to think about presenting themselves. There's no longer this assumption that we play the greatest music in the world and you should come hear it. There's
right.
an idea that
They will come.
They will come. They won't come, and we know they won't come now. And you see Alan Gilbert out there glad-handing and sort of reaching out to people.
So was it, at the end of the decade, was it a good one for classical music?
I think it was a good decade for classical music, precisely in the need to think in a more social way, the need to reach outside of the ivory tower of the concert hall. I think that was the overriding trend of the decade, and it's been couched in a lot of rhetoric of, oh, alas, the concert hall is not as full as it was. But in fact, I think it's been tremendously productive. I think the whole point of music is to communicate and have a dialogue, and the more you think about ways to do that and make it more immediate, the better you are. And it shouldn't be thought of as a remedial activity, but as a vital part of the art form.
Anne Majette is chief classical music critic of the Washington Post and with us on Soundcheck today, part of our Critics Week. So let's talk about some of the highlights of the decade. Recording-wise, your list, and Anne's full list, is on the Soundcheck page, WNYC.org, includes a couple of symphony cycles, the Beethoven symphonies.
Beethoven symphony.
Now, why do we need another cycle of these nine thrice familiar works?
Well, you might say it was the decade of the box set, and that as the classical recording industry had more and more trouble selling individual CDs, it demonstrated that it was able to sell sets of CDs, because that's very difficult to download, although there were downloads of Beethoven cycles. But you saw a lot of Beethoven cycles come out this decade. A Beethoven cycle is, of course, a measuring stick, a typical measuring stick for a new conductor with a new orchestra. And I found Osmo Vanska's cycle with the Minnesota Orchestra a really definitive statement of good, solid music making, and also a reminder of the shift we saw in American orchestras this decade from the Big Five, the traditional Chicago, Philadelphia, New York, Boston, Cleveland, to other orchestras like Los Angeles, which you mentioned, in San Francisco, certainly the two American orchestras of the decade. You had Minnesota under Vanska. More recently, you have Dallas and Pittsburgh, both of whom have new music directors and a tremendous amount of excitement and energy in those cities.
So Osmo Vanska and the Minnesota Orchestra kind of stamping their presence on the American music scene.
Absolutely.
By recording the complete symphonies of Beethoven. Vaguely familiar music from Beethoven. Osmo Vanska and the Minnesota Orchestra recorded all nine Beethoven symphonies, including the fifth. And Anne Majette, chief classical music critic of the Washington Post, put that on her list of the best classical music of the decade. Also, I mentioned there were two sets of symphonies. The other, the Shostakovich, which, you know, if the Beethoven is a measuring stick, what is it when a conductor takes on this massive set of symphonies?
Well, it's a tour de force, and it was certainly more than a decade's work. I think it was 17 years in the making or something. I'd have to check that. It's a record of Maurice Janssen's work also with a number of different orchestras, which is one of the things that makes it so valuable. I would name Maurice Janssen's one of the conductors of the decade without question, and I think it was also the decade in which he moved into international prominence. He now leads the Bavarian Radio and the Concertgebouw, two of the very best orchestras in the world, and deservedly so. And I think that this life's work of his is an adequate representation of what makes him so great.
Here is Maurice Janssen's and a little bit of the Symphony No. 13, subtitled Babi Yar by Dmitri Shostakovich. Начинали сказ, он звонко кричал, я дудочки, я дудочки, я дудочки, и лих опускался в трас. Maurice Janssen's conducting the Shostakovich Symphony No. 13 from a complete set of the Shostakovich symphonies. And one of the unusual things, as you mentioned, is one conductor, but several orchestras, Concertgebouw, and what else is in this set?
Pittsburgh, Concertgebouw.
Berlin, is that part of this? That doesn't matter. But the point is it's multiple orchestras, and what's holding it together is the vision of a single conductor, who, you know, we first knew in Oslo. He was conducting the Oslo Philharmonic.
Oslo's definitely on that set, yes.
And then went to Pittsburgh and is now this kind of international conductor of great esteem. You said that he is certainly one of the conductors of the decade. In 2006, writing for the New York Times, you called him the most important living conductor.
Well, at least I'm consistent.
So, and yet he's not, you know, in conversation, it's... it's Dudamel and Gilbert right now, you know?
Well, he's older, he's not a household name, and he's European. I mean, I think in America you've seen a lot of interest in America, or in Dudamel's case, South American conductors and artists, and I believe it's a shame that Janssens never quite got his due. Both Janssens in Pittsburgh and Temirkanov in Baltimore did superlative work and somehow never quite got the recognition, in New York anyway, that that I think they deserved for their work and that they certainly get in Europe.
Well, now there's another figure who has gotten a lot of attention and a lot of press in classical music in the past decade, and that is Peter Gelb, who famously left Sony Classical, where he was viewed by the classical industry with great suspicion because of all the crossover stuff, and took over the Met. And, you know, you remember the hue and the cry that he's going to ruin it, it's going to be all this crossover stuff. You know, it's several years into his reign now. What do you think?
Well, Peter Gelb, certainly the story of the decade in taking over the Met, and the biggest crossover venture he did at the Met was the HD broadcasts live to movie theaters around the world. And whatever you think of Peter Gelb, those broadcasts are tremendously exciting. Some people say they're bankrupting the Met. It's very difficult to get the exact figures on them, but the kind of excitement and interest and international interest that that has brought to opera has been fantastic, and a lot of other opera companies are trying to go in their wake. It opens a Pandora's box of questions about the nature of the art form, and if it's really a live form, should you be playing it to the screen, and do singers have to be skinny and beautiful and photogenic, or what happens to the fat singer? And these are all issues that Peter Gelb's tenure so far has definitely raised, and one can also raise questions about the quality of the new so-called cutting-edge productions that have happened at the house, which I think for the most part have failed to really strike an artistic chord with me. On the other hand, all power to him for trying. There's a lot of things that are right and exciting, and if some people love to hate it, it's still a place you love to hate. People have to go there to take the pulse of American opera.
And how is, I mean, we've heard, you know, operas and orchestras around the country have been in dire straits. Some have folded. What do you hear from the Met? I mean, are they really blaming the HD broadcasts as a kind of resource drain, financial drain?
It depends if whom you ask. I know some members of the board think the HD broadcasts are going to be their salvation. On a good day, if you're broadcasting Bohème or something popular and they sell out, it can make money. The figures of how much money it costs actually to do that are extremely fudgeable in what I've seen of them.
Well, let me ask you this. The Met broadcasts La Bohème in HD to your town, which, let's say, is a mid-level city that has its own regional opera. When you have the Met available in your local movie theater and you can go and for $10 sit there and watch it in high def, what's that going to do to the regional opera company?
It's only going to help it. The more, the better. It's the same myth that says that when you put baseball on TV, there will be fewer audiences for baseball in the stadium. As we all know, that's not true. Baseball audiences grew tremendously. All professional sports on TV, television has benefited professional sports. The same exact thing is true with opera. You get more interest. Furthermore, it should be remembered, the Met used to go on tour around the country. Mm-hmm. And in a way,
like the Yankees, they would barnstorm. Yeah.
Exactly.
So there is another unusual recording on your list of the best of the decade, and that is, not that there's anything weird about picking Wagner's Ring Cycle, especially from the temple of Wagner known as Bayreuth, but you've picked a strange recording conducted by Josef Keilbert. What is
this?
Well,
it was made in 1955 and I think maybe finished in 56, and it was the first stereo recording of The Ring. It was made before Schulte's recording, and then due to some contract issues, it could not be released, and it lay dormant for decades and was only released this decade complete. And it's one of the great documents of a golden age of Wagner singing, truly a rival to the Schulte Ring, and a historic document. To me, another reason to pick it is that it represents the kind of wealth of recording that is now at our fingertips thanks to the rise of new technology. We have a glut of recording, this unimaginable trove. And thanks to services like YouTube, these recordings are more readily available. One thing I've truly noticed this decade, at the beginning of the decade when you spoke to young artists, young singers about the history of opera, they didn't know the names. And today, they all know the names. They've all been on YouTube and all the recordings are there. And that's a wonderful thing about so-called new technology, that in fact it gives us our history back And that's one reason I think the cycle is important.
So if you wonder what was all the fuss about Maria Callas, and then you go to YouTube and you get to see that smoldering delivery, you're like, wow. And the same thing with Josef Keilbert's recording of The Ring by Wagner. Sound quality there, the Wagner Ring Cycle, and still to come, more of the best in classical music this decade, including a recording from a maverick-turned-established new music group. And later on Soundcheck, the female vocal ensemble known as Anonymous Four sings some unusual holiday repertoire for us live in our Soundcheck studio. It was the decade in which Bang on a Can moved from being a group of eccentric classical mavericks to established leaders in the field. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. We're looking back at the best of the decade in classical music with Anne Majette, the chief classical music critic of the Washington Post. Her complete list is on the Soundcheck page of our website, wnyc.org. Check it out. Take our listener poll. We want to know what you think were the best recordings in various genres during the past decade, and you can leave a comment. What do you think about the decade in classical music? Was it good, bad, indifferent? Leave a comment on the Soundcheck page, wnyc.org. And Bang on a Can, group formed by three composers, Michael Gordon, Julia Wolf, David Lang. David won the Pulitzer Prize.
David won the Pulitzer Prize. I would say in 2000, when you heard Bang on a Can, you would never have expected that by the end of the decade, David Lang would have a Pulitzer, and all three of them would be really ensconced at the forefront of an empire. They founded a record label this decade. They established a summer institute. They've influenced an entire generation now of young composers. I think they've been hugely influential in the way younger artists are approaching music making.
Now, how do you mean? Do you mean by the nuts and bolts of how they put notes on staff paper, or do you mean how they get their art out to a community, or both?
Both, absolutely both. I mean, Bang on a Can was maverick precisely for using influences from rock music, from jazz, from world music, for putting an electric guitar on stage. Their ensemble, the performing arm, the Bang on a Can All-Stars, has an electric guitar as well as a piano. It specializes in unusual instrumentation. And that's really par for the course now. I get debate from people who say we don't even need to call it a different name. That is classical music now, the idea that this is all open. But Bang on a Can, they weren't the first to do it, but they were pioneers in doing it. And I think also the record label, Cantaloupe Records, has put out some excellent releases and helped sort of define an ethos that has been picked up and continued by other labels we've seen spring up.
So analogous to what's happened in the rock world, where you've had this, you know, indie rock labels sprouting like mushrooms after a storm, it's happening in the classical music world, too.
It's absolutely happening in classical, particularly as the advantages of signing with a big label are no longer as evident. You don't have the artistic control, and there are no clear advantages of distribution.
Just taking a look at some of the comments coming in on the website, Rich from the Upper East Side writes, "It was a great decade for classical. I love the Anna Netrebko recordings." Hot. Yeah, I am reading that right. He wrote hot. Now, that's, you know, I mean, that you have to have the face out there in front of people for people to say, yeah, that's hot. Is that what it's about? I guess that's what it's always been about, right? Is getting the names and the faces and the music out in front of people.
Absolutely. I mean, you could say that the cult of stardom, well, that's always been a part of opera. There's always been an idol aspect, the poster on the bedroom wall. And Anna Netrebko certainly epitomized that this decade.
But she was in a Hollywood film. Was it Princess Diaries 2 or something? She was in some kind of major, film that my kids saw. So they knew who Anna Netrebko was from that. And, you know,
it's an interesting issue with Netrebko because it was also a decade of hothouse opera careers, as you saw beautiful and promising talents come and go very quickly. I've said elsewhere that Villazon, Rolando Villazon, who for a while was Netrebko's onstage partner as part of the new love couple, and then sang himself to shreds. He's an unfortunate sort of poster child for this decade in terms of having all of the ability and talent, and he's a tremendous talent, but taking so many roles and oversinging or something going wrong to such a degree that he's really not singing well, although another comeback is in the cards, but the last couple of comebacks have not done that well.
Well, in the composing realm, of course, there have been names that have sort of come to the fore and then disappeared just as quickly, but John Adams was kind of a slow burn through the 80s, and then in this decade, man, the guy was everywhere. He's on your list. You could have chosen any number of recordings. You chose Dharma at Big Sur.
I did. Many people might say Dr. Atomic and A Flowering Tree. He wrote two major operas this decade. But I think the real point is that he became sort of the grand old man of classical music. He curates everybody's new music festival. He's the composer in residence with the LA Philharmonic and elsewhere. He's written major works that have been performed in many places. And he's sort of the polarizing figure, if you will, of classical music today.
And even this piece, Dharma at Big Sur, ostensibly a kind of violin concerto, except that Tracy Silverman's violin has additional strings and is an electric violin.
An electric violin with six strings. That's a piece for the decade.
From John Adams. Dharma at Big Sur by John Adams, the California composer. He wrote this piece for Tracy Silverman, the LA Phil. He wrote it, actually, Anne, for the opening of Disney Hall, right?
I believe that's right, yes. He had a couple of big orchestral commissions this decade because On the Transmigration of Souls was his New York Philharmonic piece commemorating 9/11, and that won him the Pulitzer Prize, and in a way that's what catapulted him into his position of prominence. Not that he was exactly unknown before, but that established him as a sort of national voice. But one reason I picked Dharma at Big Sur as opposed to other pieces is I feel that that has some of the antic quirkiness of Adams at his best, and some of the bigger pieces take on a sort of serious, even ponderous quality that doesn't speak to me as much.
But John Adams, certainly, one of the composers of the decade, part of Anne Majette's list. And again, her complete list of the best in classical music of this decade is on the soundcheck page, WNYC.org. There are a number of other things. We won't have time. I do want to mention the Peter Lieberson songs because, it's almost too heartbreaking to listen to, but the Neruda songs, tell the story.
He wrote these songs for his wife, Lorraine Hunt Lieberson, the mezzo-soprano whose death this decade was one of the worst of as far as losses to classical music. They are love songs, heartbreakingly beautiful, were premiered by the Boston Symphony under James Levine, and she sang them. And it's one of the great documents of any decade. I think they're beautiful, beautiful songs.
And they were literally her swan song.
They were literally her swan song.
On a happier note, good decade for pianists.
It was indeed, yes.
Pierre-Laurent Aimard, brainy young Frenchman, comes out of nowhere at the beginning of the decade and makes it onto your list.
Absolutely. I mean, Pierre-Laurent, somebody who had been percolating for a while, working with Boulez's ensemble in Paris, and developing his chops, and this was the decade he was ready to take flight, and pretty much anything he did was interesting. I had a hard time picking an album, but I think he's one of the artists of the decade, whether it was Charles Ives or Messiaen. There were a lot of important pieces, and he did Bach as well. Mm-hmm. And he became the director of the Aldeburgh Festival. He did fascinating concerts at Carnegie Hall. He really showed a penetrating artistic curiosity that was tremendously refreshing and that people responded to tremendously.
He's played Messiaen on our piano here in the studio, and to watch him play is a memorable experience. Speaking of memories, I mean, this decade saw the return of someone that we thought had been consigned to memory decades ago, namely Leon Fleischer. You are now writing a book about Leon Fleischer. What is so compelling about this guy's story?
I'm writing a book about and with Leon, so I have no distance on the story whatsoever. But after he was struck down in 1965 by a neurological condition called focal dystonia and was unable to play basically for more than 30 years and regained the use of his right hand with a great deal of struggle and still not to the degree it was, but it's a tremendous story of having a second chance and overcoming the odds that captured the popular imagination, which is why he had a book commissioned from him.
And his comeback album was called, simply and appropriately,
Two Hands.
And this is from it. Leon Fleischer, using both hands in this Chopin Nocturne in D-flat major, Opus 27, number 2, and forthcoming book by my guest Anne Majette and Leon Fleischer, detailing his story, his comeback from focal dystonia after decades, literally, of not being able to use the right hand. There was another inspirational sort of pianist story of the decade, and it comes from just two blocks from where I live in Brooklyn, Simona Dinerstein. I mean, you want to talk about coming out of nowhere. Yeah. An appropriate place to leave it. What is so inspirational about her story?
Well, she's a story for the decade in that she was an artist who had something to say and wasn't getting the chances to say it in along conventional means, wasn't winning competitions, didn't have the big contests or concerts, and therefore decided to go and record a piece herself that meant a lot to her. And it is possible today to record the Goldberg Variations yourself and get enough attention for it that you get picked up by a major
label. If you're good.
If you're good. It's a very original, distinctive take on the Goldbergs.
And as you said earlier, Osmo Venska recording the Beethoven cycles, that was a kind of, you know, a statement, a calling card, you know, a measuring stick. Goldberg Variations as well. There, you know, Glenn
Absolutely.
Gould, you got lots of classic recordings of this. Simona Dinerstein stacks up well and is on Anne Majette's list of the 10 classical albums of the decade. Anne, always a pleasure to have you with us on Soundcheck.
Thanks for having me.
And coming up next, some holiday choral music right here in our studio, courtesy of the group Anonymous 4. It won't be what you think. That's coming up next on Soundcheck.
Check out today's Soundcheck blog.
For me, in classical music, this was the decade of Osvaldo Golijov. He started on a high note with his 2000 setting of the St. Mark Passion, peaked again in the middle of the decade with Aire, his electroacoustic tour of the Mediterranean, and finally in this last year of the decade, we were able to ask him to write a new piece for the opening of our green space.
For the rest of the story, visit the Soundcheck page at WNYC.org.